Hello, this is episode number 23 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, August 2nd, 2007. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. On this week's show, we're going to engage in a mini-debate about libertarianism and open networks as how those concepts apply to the 700 megahertz auction. Over the past 2 weeks, several of our contributors in the Tech Liberation Front blog have been commenting on the auction and the implications of the so-called open access provisions that have become the source of great controversy. Joining us this week to discuss these issues are my fellow Technology Liberation Front contributors, Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Adam.
Cord Bloomquist of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Hi, Cord.
Hello.
Jerry Brito of the Mercatus Center. Hi, Jerry.
Hello.
And Jim Harper of the Cato Institute. Hi, Jim.
Howdy, Adam.
Jerry, I'm going to start with you, since you really helped get this discussion rolling at the TLF blog months ago with some of your essays about these issues. Tell us a bit more about what's going on this front and why it's so hot right now and why it's important.
Well, what's going on is that right now television is on analog. It's taking up a lot of spectrum. And with a move to digital television, they're moving it to a different spectrum that broadcasters are actually using right now. And so Congress told the FCC there's about 84 megahertz of spectrum that you need to auction off, and you have a deadline of early February 2008 to do it by. And so it told the FCC to go and auction off that spectrum. In fact, it said 84 megahertz is what's going to be transferred. 24 of that is going to go to public safety, so that's police, fire, whatnot. And 60 megahertz you're going to auction off, and you decide how to do that. So the FCC has been considering, number one, what sort of allocation rules to place on the spectrum. So that is, what sizes blocks of the 60? Are you going to have 6 10 megahertz blocks? Are you going to have 2 30 megahertz blocks, et cetera? What sort of services are going to be allowed on these blocks of spectrum? Are they going to be national or regional, et cetera, et cetera? And also, what kind of auction to have for the spectrum? So 2 days ago, the FCC finally came out with its rules. And in between, you have had a coalition of net neutrality proponents, spearheaded, it looks like, by Google, who wanted really to get open access mandates on parts of the spectrum. And Google, in particular, was asking for a 20 megahertz block of spectrum that it wanted to have four requirements on it. Number one is open applications, which means that if a wireless network is built on that spectrum, the users of that network could use any application as long as it was a lawful application. Open devices mean that, that the wireless network owner could not limit what device the consumer could use on the network. Wholesale and resale, meaning that the wireless network owner would allow others to interconnect with it and resell their services. So, the FCC, what they did was, Kevin Martin, who's the FCC, came up with a plan where it would meet Google halfway and offer open access to open applications and open devices for that 20 megahertz chunk. At first, the Bell companies who own some of the wireless companies like Verizon and AT&T were opposed to this, but then they sort of seemed to warm up to the compromise and went along with it to see what Google would say. Google said that it would only accept all four provisions. And in the end, they said that it would actually bid up to the reserve price, or starting with the reserve price of $4.6 billion, if all four encumbrances were met. And, of course, cynics might say, like myself, that one of the reasons Google wants to have all these encumbrances on the spectrum is because that would the price that they would have to pay for the spectrum.
Well, let's get into the openness question, the open access issues, and maybe I can bring in Cord here to talk a little bit more about that and about the good and the bad of that.
I brought up this concern on the blog earlier this week about, what are the real advantages and disadvantages of having a closed system. Certainly open systems are more widely used. The internet is the prime example of a big open system, but there are other examples we can look at of open and closed systems, like PCs versus Macs. PCs are much more open than Macs, and Macs usually provide a stable platform than PCs. You can have a wide variety of apps on PCs that aren't necessarily made for them. But another example would be Google itself owns a giant closed network that connects its own server farms, and I doubt that Google would want open access rules put on its own private server farm to server farm network. And I think that certainly I'm not saying let's switch everything over to a closed system, although there are some people who might advocate that. I'm saying closed systems may have a value. They're a limited value. Certainly going to be used in the minority of cases, but it does provide advantages for security, reliability, guaranteed compatibility that open networks don't provide. And while open networks may be used 95% of the time, let's not outlaw closed networks for the small number of applications that they are useful for.
I don't really disagree with that. I certainly would not say that it's never appropriate to have a closed network. But I think that there's sort of a tick among libertarians where, you know, if somebody's proposing a law against drinking bleach, that some libertarian gets up and, you know, argues why it's a good idea to drink bleach. I mean, the question of whether, you know, the technical question of whether open networks are good and bad is entirely separate from the policy question of whether mandating open networks is a good idea. And it seems to me that on the technical question, not always, but pretty close to always, you'll find that open networks and open systems tend to outperform closed networks and closed systems. And as I said on the blog, the two major reasons for that is one, that you have network effects where the more users you have for a particular platform, the more valuable that platform tends to be. And the other is low barriers to entry. So you want to be able to have small startup companies bring their products to a particular platform in a very easy way. You tend to have more innovation and more high-quality products. So that was my basic point. And I think that that some libertarians, and maybe Cord's not among them, but I think some libertarians jump a little bit too much on the maybe openness isn't such a good idea bandwagon. And one of the reasons I think that's bad is that it undermines our case somewhat to what I think is an important target audience, which is left-of-center techies who are pretty sympathetic to the idea that, you know, bureaucracies are bad and that, putting the FCC in charge of things is not necessarily a good idea. But if they hear arguments about openness that they don't agree with, they're not going to listen to the policy and economic arguments for why mandating these sort of things isn't a good idea.
Let me just ask Tim and Cord a question and chew on that just a little bit more. Between the two of you, there's sort of different sides of an open and closed argument. I guess the point that we can all come together on is that it's a very bad idea for a government agency to get together with a corporation or any set of corporations and decide, okay, we're going to try this business model for a while. And if it doesn't work, you know, what happens then? Is it going to be a couple of years or is it going to be a couple of decades before it gets deployed, which redeploy the spectrum, which is why I suppose we all think that having these rules put forth by the FCC is a bad idea. Is that a good synthesis of where you guys are coming from?
Yeah, I think we agree on that, and we've been ignoring the sort of like financial business model end of the question. I mean, this network has to be built out. Somebody has to somehow make money on this. Would it be the case that having a closed network sort of resembling the cell phone network would provide for a better business model for at least the initial investment phase of this, getting it built out? Before there's a network, the network really has no value.
But I think what Jim is hinting at is that under the rules that sort of would have been in place had the FCC not acted the way it did, Google, if it thought it had a better business model, could have established an open network. And who knows, if it somehow could have done it advertiser-supported or whatever, maybe it would have been successful. But they were never prohibited. The problem here is, as Jim says, is when Google lobbies the government successfully to put restrictions on what can be done on the spectrum so that you can only have an open network. It's sort of, you know, open or else.
Yeah, I think one consideration here that maybe makes libertarians a little bit uncomfortable is the argument that One of the differences between an open and closed system is that because open systems tend to be more competitive, the benefits of the open system often flow more towards consumers and less towards towards the network provider, who in a sense in a closed system has more market power. So in a closed cell phone network, for example, you're able to say sell ringtones, which you wouldn't be able to do that if cell phones were open products, or at least it wouldn't be as easy because there'd be more competition in the market for ringtones. And I guess the way I would approach a question like that is I would say that from a consumer's perspective, it's better if the consumer has the option to get ringtones from more than one vendor. With a caveat, however, that if you enact policies that leads to the network not being built in the first place, obviously you're not benefiting consumers. So you do ultimately want markets to make you do want to let private companies, make those investment decisions and reap the rewards of those investment decisions. But from a purely technical perspective, the open network, I think, is generally going to work better because you are going to have more competition and lower barriers to entry.
As I've given all these issues more thought, I've really come to think about what a tempest in a teapot kind of issue this is. And I think it's worthwhile to sort of step away from it and talk about all the different ways of allocating spectrum that we could use. The one where the box we're in right now, of course, as you all know, is command and control. And Tim, you've done a lot of good writing about how command and control of spectrum or in any regulatory environment creates a lot of rent seeking and regulatory capture and things like that, and tends to lock in incumbency on the part of large providers. That's what we're talking about here, and the question is which of the behemoth telecommunication or internet firms is going to get the goodies from the FCC. Another way entirely of dealing with spectrum, of course, is often called propertyization. That is not necessarily privatization, but it is to make the spectrum much more like property, so that a person owns a certain right to use spectrum, and then they can sell it, or they can divide it and sell it. They can recombine it in all kinds of different ways. And spectrum is fascinating because it has so many different dimensions, and you could sell dimensions of time, you could sell different angles and all kinds of other things. We put out a paper at the Cato Institute on this point called Toward Property Rights in Spectrum, the Difficult Policy Choices Ahead. It's not easy to create property rights, but it's another great way to do it. A third way that has been more and more interesting to me as I've studied it more is treatment of spectrum as a commons. When a good is so abundant it's really inefficient to create markets in it, because negotiation and payment and things like that is a drag on exchange. When it's so abundant, you can treat it as a commons, and anybody can use it. And with advanced radio technologies, you could treat spectrum as a commons, and potentially anyone could communicate anything they want on a piece of spectrum or on a wide swath of spectrum. And only minimal regulation, like preventing people from sending out 100,000-watt signals on every part of the spectrum, only that minimal regulation would be necessary.
I want to push back a little bit on that idea of a commons being a third way, like you said. When you have, you're saying you would only need minimal regulation, but in the end, that is still command and control regulation, setting the rules of what you can and cannot do on a swath of spectrum, and you would have the same rent seeking you have today with command and control. Also, I'm not too sure, although I definitely have hope for the future, that we have technologies that make use of spectrum today anywhere near as abundant as you would need to have that sort of. So I'm just very cautious. I do see FCC going more and more in this direction of a commons, because it is theoretically very attractive.
Yeah.
But I'm really concerned about what real life implications it has.
Those are good points, and I've had some discussions along those lines with people who are strong proponents of commons treatment, and they are quite theoretical about it. Now, the theoretical radio exists, and the theoretical regulation exists. How you get there from here is another problem. And one of the thoughts I've had that I'd love to see happen, it's one that's not appealing to people who believe in sort of the pure way of getting to a commons, is to get a consortium of companies together that will profit from commons treatment. You could take a Google, you could take an Intel and a Cisco, and do to transmitters and receivers what were done with personal computers, so that there is a mesh network that's owned by everybody, and these guys can sell the machinery that does that and make their billions of dollars there. Then they have the incentive not to slice and dice spectrum, but to maintain the minimal commons-based regulation and frankly minimize it.
If you do that, where you have, and that's a terrific idea, where you have Intel and Google or whoever partnering, buying spectrum, so you have the proper decision you're talking about, and then allowing that spectrum to be used by anybody who just buys one of the devices, and then it's just free and open. That
yeah.
is a true commons. Because there's a bit of a misunderstanding about what a commons is. A commons ultimately is property. It's property that's owned and managed jointly. Okay. People sort of confuse the idea of a commons with an open access regime, a place where anybody can come in and use it with nobody's permission. That's actually called open access. And when you have that, you do have a tragedy. And Garrett Hardin later admitted that he shouldn't have called his paper The Tragedy of the Commons. He should have called it The Tragedy of the Open Access. Because the commons actually is a situation where the folks who are using the resource all know each other and are all keeping an eye out on each other, and abusers are punished.
Well, there's also an issue of scarcity, though, isn't there? I mean, to take the example that the commons people always cite, the Wi-Fi, in fact, is open access in the sense that that pretty much anybody can transmit anything they want within a certain power range on that frequency. And for that purpose, on that band, you know, given the, you know, just the way the world works, it does in fact turn out that there isn't really any scarcity of that spectrum. Now, if somebody wanted to broadcast at 10 or 100 times the power, then you would have contention and so you'd need some sort of more invasive regulation.
It's not just the energy regulations that sort of allow Wi-Fi to work. Wi-Fi is able to work in large part because of physical property rights. You deploy your Wi-Fi network over your home or your coffee shop or your campus, and it's those physical property rights that also allow such a free-flowing thing to work.
So, guys, what would be, I think, you know, what would be the position we would want to articulate as libertarians on this question of openness for spectrum or other things? I mean, one of the things that my former colleague at Cato, Wayne Cruz, and I tried to articulate in a book that we wrote about open access regulation in terms of wireline infrastructure is that we thought the proper libertarian position towards these questions of openness should essentially be one of agnosticism, which was, you know, open versus closed systems are interesting technical or engineering or economic questions, even business questions. But when they're elevated to the realm of public policy, that's when I think we all get a little bit nervous, as we are here. And I think I'm hoping we can all agree that the position should be, no, let's not have regulators or policymakers decide how open or closed a given market is. Let's let the market decide that.
I agree with that. I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind here is that open isn't one thing. I mean, open
right.
is one dimension along which you have to make decisions. The problem with the government mandated openness, in my view, is that in the process of dictating openness, often the government gets into the position where it has to dictate a lot of other technical details that governments are not well positioned to make, and you again open up the door for all sorts of rent seeking opportunities where each of those technical details that are sort of preconditions of mandating openness or part of the openness mandate are decisions that benefit or harm particular parties in the marketplace. And so the government can't simply pass a law that says this network shall be open. It has to pass a law that says this network will be open in this way and use this protocol and support these devices and, you know, charge these prices. I mean, once you open that door, all the details of how the network will work become subject to the political process as opposed to the market process, and that, you know, creates all the problems that we love to talk about.
I think your articulation of things were quite good, Adam. I for one, would like to see an open network. I'd like this kind of thing to work, and I don't think it should be a product of regulation. I think Google, if they want to build it, they should definitely build it. It'll be great for them if they make money as an open ISP. It'll be even better for them because they'll make a lot of money out of the expanded use of the Internet in their search products. I don't think they should get windfall profits thanks to government regulations biased things in their favor.
Right, and this is something that I think Hans talked about the last time we talked about this a couple weeks ago that I think was a really good point, and that is that Google, what Google may do is they may, you know, get this spectrum at a cut-rate price because of this open mandate. Then they might, you know, take a try at making the open network, and if it doesn't work, they'll come back to the FCC and said, sorry, we tried it, it didn't work, could we please build a closed network? And in a sense, then that becomes a way for them to get spectrum on the cheap, and then using the political process to in fact get the spectrum for the more highly valued use. So this will never be a purely one-off decision about will this network be open or closed. It will always be, as long as the government is second-guessing the spectrum owner about what uses could be put to, that's always going to be something that's contestable within the political process. And so I think it's better to have that money go to the Treasury directly rather than letting some auction owner reap this windfall profit and then end up having a closed network anyway.
When do we find out what happens, guys? When's the big auction?
The law that Congress passed, so the actual act, requires the FCC to have the auction done and done by, I believe it's mid-February, like February 16th or something like that is the date. These things usually take a couple of months to run the auction. So the idea is that by October, the auction will begin. Before October, we'll know who is bidding on this, and so we'll know that. I'm not sure. I don't know if you guys can tell me. I guess we don't have the actual rules out yet. But is there a ground for a legal challenge here at all, even before the auction gets started? Because I'm sure that there will be a legal challenge once the auction is completed.
I don't know the answer to that, Jerry. But you know what? When in doubt, the answer is yes. there will be a challenge because we know almost everything of importance that has a big, dollar sign attached to it at the FCC is challenged in some way, shape, or form. And again, that gets to the point of legal uncertainty, and it's the problem that pervades almost everything the FCC does is that it becomes so controversial or is done in such an arbitrary way that it becomes the challenge, part of a legal challenge, and that's just not a good way to be making law for important high-tech industries. And yet we find ourselves in that position again here for this incredibly valuable spectrum that we should be getting out on the market as quickly as possible. So
one of the costs of the command and control environment, and folks who think, oh, we'll just redeploy spectrum if it doesn't work, we're really talking about years and years and years of not only regulation but also the litigation that follows it. So
we should make mention of the fact that the auction will be sometime early next year, but then the actual spectrum, Jerry, correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't get actually redeployed and start even being available for use until mid-2009?
That's correct.
Is that correct?
Right. That's correct. And again, that's if there are no legal challenges along the way.
Right.
You can think of what's the name of that company that was with Janice Obuchowski at the head?
Next Wave,
right. who in the mid-90s won, I think James Katusa talked about this last time. One spectrum, it didn't, wasn't able to pay for it, I guess, ultimately, and this valuable load of spectrum was just tied up in bankruptcy court for almost a decade.
Right. Right, and that was a result largely of the FCC there rigging the auction rules to try to create preferences for certain groups and to have a supposedly more optimal scenario, and it resulted in very suboptimal results with spectrum being tied up forever.
I wanted to mention something that James Katusa also mentioned last time we talked about this, and it sort of goes to Jim's point about privatization. I think Congress thought, or who knows, maybe they're not so naive, but I think Congress was thinking that they were, that command and control didn't work, and so they were trying to get to a more proprietized sort of model, and so they decided to go with auctions. But of course, command and control has two components. One is allocation, and one is assignment, right? Allocation is the part where you decide what the spectrum can be used for and what sort of limits and rules are imposed on it. And assignment is deciding who gets what chunk of spectrum. By giving the FCC authority to auction something off, you're only taking care of the assignment problem, because the FCC before would just hold comparative hearings and dog and pony shows and would pick a winner. Now at least you've solved that problem, that rent-seeking problem, by having an auction. But that having an auction doesn't solve the allocation problem, where the FCC can still decide what the spectrum can be used for, what rules. And the FCC has sort of gone backwards, because it really had been going in a direction of allowing spectrum to be a lot more flexible use. And with this ruling, they've really taken a step back.
like Charlton Heston with his long rifle, a regulatory agency lets go of its authority over its cold, dead hands.
That's right.
Okay, well, that's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this week. I want to thank Jerry, Jim, Cord, and Tim for joining me this week. And to read more commentary from the entire Technology Liberation Front gang, please visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you'd like to comment about something we said here today, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Adam Thier. See you then.